The Age of Innocence by Edith Wharton. On a January evening of the early 70s, Christine Nielsen was singing in Faust at the Academy of Music in New York. It was Madame Nielsen's first appearance that winter, and what the daily press had already learned to describe as an exceptionally brilliant audience had gathered to hear her. When Newland Archer opened the door at the back of the club box, the curtain had just gone up on the garden scene. He turned his eyes from the stage and scanned the opposite side of the house. Directly facing him was the box of old Mrs. Manson Mingott, whose monstrous obesity had long since made it impossible for her to attend the opera, but who was always represented on fashionable nights by some of the younger members of the family. On this occasion, the front of the box was filled by her daughter-in-law, Mrs. Lovell Mingott, and her daughter, Mrs. Welland, and slightly withdrawn behind these brocaded matrons sat a young girl in white, with eyes ecstatically fixed on the stage lovers. She dropped her eyes to the immense bouquet of lilies of the valley on her knee, and Newland Archer saw her white glove fingertips touch the flowers softly. He contemplated her absorbed young face with a thrill of possessorship, in which pride in his own masculine initiation was mingled with a tender reverence for her abysmal purity. "We'll read Faust together by the Italian lakes," he thought, somewhat hazily confusing the scene of his projected honeymoon with the masterpieces of literature which it would be his manly privilege to reveal to his bride. It was only that afternoon that May Welland had let him guess that she cared, New York's consecrated phrase of maiden avowal, and already his imagination, leaping ahead of the engagement ring, the betrothal kiss, and the march from Lohengrin, pictured her at his side in some scene of old European witchery.
"Well, upon my soul," exclaimed Lawrence Lefferts, turning his opera glass abruptly away from the stage. Lawrence Lefferts was, on the whole, the foremost authority on form in New York. He silently handed his glass to old Sillerton Jackson. Newland Archer, following Lefferts' glance, saw with surprise that his exclamation had been occasioned by the entry of a new figure into old Mrs. Mingott's box. It was that of a slim young woman, a little less tall than May Welland, with brown hair growing in close curls about her temples and held in place by a narrow band of diamonds. Mr. Sillerton Jackson had returned the opera glass to Lawrence Lefferts. For a moment he silently scrutinized the attentive group out of his filmy blue eyes overhung by old veined lids. Then he gave his moustache a thoughtful twist and said simply,
"I didn't think the Mingotts would have tried it on."
But they had. They undoubtedly had. For the low-toned comments behind him left no doubt in Archer's mind that the young woman was May Welland's cousin, the cousin always referred to in the family as poor Ellen Olenska. Archer knew that she had suddenly arrived from Europe a day or two previously. He had even heard from Miss Welland, not disapprovingly, that she had been to see poor Ellen, who was staying with old Mrs. Mingott. Archer entirely approved of family solidarity, and one of the qualities he most admired in the Mingotts was their resolute championship of the few black sheep that their blameless stock had produced. There was nothing mean or ungenerous in the young man's heart, and he was glad that his future wife should not be restrained by false prudery from being kind in private to her unhappy cousin. But to receive Countess Olenska in the family circle was a different thing from producing her in public, at the opera of all places, and in the very box with a young girl whose engagement to him, Newland Archer, was to be announced within a few weeks.
"After all," he heard one of the younger men begin behind him, "after all, just what happened?" "Well, she left him," Nobody attempts to deny that. He's an awful brute, isn't he? Continued the young inquirer, who was evidently preparing to enter the lists as the lady's champion.
The very worst. I knew him at Nice, said Lawrence Lefferts with authority. A half-paralyzed, white, sneering fellow. Rather handsome head, but eyes with a lot of lashes. Well, I'll tell you the sort. When he wasn't with women, he was collecting china, paying any price for both, I understand.
There was a general laugh, and her young champion said, Well, then?
Well, then she bolted with his secretary.
Oh, I see. The champion's face fell.
It didn't last long, though. I heard of her a few months later living alone in Venice. I believe Lovell Mingott went out to get her. He said she was desperately unhappy. Well, that's all right, but this parading her at the opera is another thing.
The act was ending, and there was a general stir in the box. Suddenly, Newland Archer felt himself impelled to decisive action. The desire to be the first man to enter Mrs. Mingott's box, to proclaim to the waiting world his engagement to May Welland and to see her through whatever difficulties her cousin's anomalous situation might involve her in, this impulse had abruptly overruled all scruples and hesitations and sent him hurrying through the red corridors to the farther side of the house. As he entered the box, his eyes met Miss Welland's, and he saw that she had instantly understood his motive, though the family dignity which both considered so high a virtue would not permit her to tell him so.
"You know my niece, Countess Olenska?" Mrs. Welland inquired as she shook hands with her future son-in-law.
Archer bowed without extending his hand, as was the custom on being introduced to a lady, and Ellen Olenska bent her head slightly, keeping her own pale-gloved hands clasped on her huge fan of eagle feathers. Having greeted Mrs. Lovell Mingott, a large blonde lady in creaking satin, he sat down beside his betrothed and said in a low tone, "I hope you've told Madame Olenska that we're engaged. I want everybody to know. I want you to let me announce it this evening at the ball." Miss Welland's face grew rosy as the dawn, and she looked at him with radiant eyes. "If you can persuade Mama," she said, "but why should we change what is already settled?" He made no answer but that which his eyes returned, and she added still more confidently, smiling, "Tell my cousin yourself. I give you leave. She says she used to play with you when you were children." She made way for him by pushing back her chair, and promptly and a little ostentatiously, with the desire that the whole house should see what he was doing, Archer seated himself at the Countess Olenska's side. "We did used to play together, didn't we?" she asked, turning her grave eyes to his. "You were a horrid boy and kissed me once behind a door. But it was your cousin Vandy Newland, who never looked at me, that I was in love with." Her glance swept the horseshoe curve of boxes. "Ah, how this brings it all back to me. I see everybody here in knickerbockers and pantalettes," she said with her trailing, slightly foreign accent, her eyes returning to his face. Agreeable as their expression was, the young man was shocked that they should reflect so unseemly a picture of the august tribunal before which, at that very moment, her case was being tried. Nothing could be in worse taste than misplaced flippancy, and he answered somewhat stiffly, "Yes, you've been away a very long time." "Oh, centuries and centuries. So long," she said, "that I'm sure I'm dead and buried, and this dear old place is heaven." Which, for reasons he could not define, struck Newland Archer as an even more disrespectful way of describing New York society. It invariably happened in the same way. Mrs. Julius Beaufort, on the night of her annual ball, never failed to appear at the opera. Mrs. Archer, who was fond of coining her social philosophy into axioms, had once said, We all have our pet common people. And though the phrase was a daring one, its truth was secretly admitted in many an exclusive bosom. But the Beauforts were not exactly common. Some people said they were even worse. Mrs. Beaufort belonged indeed to one of America's most honored families. And when one was related to the Mansons and Rushworths, one had a droit de cité, as Mr. Sillerton Jackson, who had frequented the Tuileries, called it, in New York society. But did one not forfeit it in marrying Julius Beaufort? The question was, who was Beaufort? He passed for an Englishman, was agreeable, handsome, ill-tempered, hospitable, and witty. He had come to America with letters of recommendation from old Mrs. Manson Mingott's English son-in-law, the banker, and had speedily made himself an important position in the world of affairs. But his habits were dissipated, his tongue was bitter, his antecedents were mysterious, and when Medora Manson announced her cousin's engagement to him, it was felt to be one more act of folly in poor Medora's long record of imprudences. But folly is as often justified of her children as wisdom. And 2 years after young Mrs. Beaufort's marriage, it was admitted that she had the most distinguished house in New York. And for over 20 years now, people had said they were going to the Beauforts with the same tone of security as if they had said they were going to Mrs. Manson Mingott's. Newland Archer, as became a young man of his position, strolled into the ball somewhat late. He was distinctly nervous, being definitely afraid that the Mingotts might be going too far, that in fact they might have Granny Mingott's orders to bring the Countess Olenska to the ball. Wandering on to the Bouton d'Or drawing room, Archer found Mrs. Welland and her daughter standing near the ballroom door. Miss Welland, evidently about to join the dancers, hung on the threshold, her face a little pale, her eyes burning with a candid excitement. A group of young men and girls were gathered about her, and there was much hand-clasping, laughing, and pleasantry, on which Mrs. Welland, standing slightly apart, shed the beam of a qualified approval. It was evident that Miss Welland was in the act of announcing her engagement, while her mother affected the air of parental reluctance considered suitable to the occasion. Archer paused a moment. The group about Miss Welland made way for him with significant smiles, and after taking his share of the felicitations, he drew his betrothed into the middle of the ballroom floor and put his arm about her waist. "Now we shan't have to talk," he said, smiling into her candid eyes, as they floated away on the soft waves of the Blue Danube. The dance over, the two, as became an affianced couple, wandered into the conservatory, and sitting behind a tall screen of tree ferns and camellias, Newland pressed her gloved hand to his lips. "Did you tell my cousin Ellen?" she asked presently, as if she spoke through a dream. He roused himself and remembered that he had not done so. Some invincible repugnance to speak of such things to the strange foreign woman had checked the words on his lips.
"No, I hadn't the chance after all," he said, fibbing hastily.
"Has she come?"
"No, at the last minute she decided not to. She suddenly made up her mind that her dress wasn't smart enough for the ball, though we thought it so lovely, and so my aunt had to take her home."
"Oh, well," said Archer with happy indifference.
"She knows as well as I do," he reflected, "the real reason of her cousin staying away. But I shall never let her see by the least sign that I am conscious of there being a shadow of a shade on poor Ellen Olenska's reputation."